of success. I think it's the safe return doubtful part that would have done me in right at that stage. But it didn't for thousands of people. Amazingly, thousands of men responded to that advertisement. And they did it largely because of the man who signed his name underneath it. His name was Ernest Shackleton. He was a British naval lieutenant, as they would say, a lieutenant. And he didn't have very many resources. He didn't have government funding. He didn't have big financial backing. He had a ship that was questionable, but he already had a reputation of a man of integrity, a man of skill, a man of courage. And there were quite literally all kinds of people willing to go to the ends of the earth if Ernest Shackleton was going to lead them. He had four expeditions to the South Pole, never made it there, got close, but never got there. And as you read about those expeditions, even today, they are both thrilling and terrifying at the same time. All kinds of episodes of raw courage and endurance and occasional little bit of foolishness thrown in. But Ernest Shackleton is a man who's fascinated me, and I've read a number of accounts of his life. One biographer describes him like this, and comparing him to some of the other polar explorers, said, "For scientific discovery, give me Scott. For speed and efficiency of travel, give me a Munson. But when danger strikes and all hope is gone, get down on your knees and pray for Shackleton. Not for him, the easy task and the quick success. He was at his best when the going was toughest." That last phrase has been important enough for me to remember it without trying to. Not for him, the easy task and the quick success. He was at his best when the going was toughest. Reason that resonates with me is not that I have any interest in going to the South Pole or the North Pole. Flying over it would be just fine with me. But I do think that we've been called to live in a time in which it is challenging. We live in a rapidly changing world. Our culture is going through mega changes in almost every kind of way, and everything that isn't nailed down seems to be coming loose, and even what is nailed down all of a sudden seems to be being pried loose. And all we need to think of is how many things have changed that are assumed in life over the last 30 or 40 years. How do you walk wisely in a time like this? How do you live walking through all of these changes and not lose your head and not lose your heart and not lose your sense of direction? I was intrigued by the visual that has been put in front of us with all of these footsteps that are across the front, because I remember as a boy in Canada, there was a political campaign and the slogan was simply "Follow John." John Diefenbaker, and the Conservative Party stenciled footsteps all over everywhere. "Follow John." Well, he got elected and was a disaster as a prime minister, but that's fairly commonplace. But it strikes me as I thought about this that following John may not be a good idea, but following Jesus is the only good idea in terms of how do we walk wisely in the time in which we live. We need some models. How do we keep from being misdirected? And we think of some of the signposts that are here that are in our society that take us off in different directions. How do we walk to get to the destination that's appropriate? How do we keep the world from squeezing us into its mold? Last week, we looked at the idea that wise walking means that we are to live in the middle of a crooked and depraved generation that's dark, and we are in that context to shine as lights in the universe. This morning, I want to think with you about an issue that's important. And it's kind of the overall issue of the squeezing of our society. The kind of enculturation process of the world around us that presses us and squeezes us. And I have a hero I want to set in front of you. On one level, he's a rather unlikely hero. He is a 14 or 15-year-old boy. 14-year-old, 15-year-old boy who has been deported from his home country and is left with virtually no visible means of support. And yet Daniel is one of my heroes in the Bible. A young man who lived to the age of 85 and more in a corrupt pagan society, not only made or kept his integrity, but made a contribution. So I'd like you to turn with me to the book of Daniel in the Old Testament. For those of you who are a little less familiar with your Bible, if you open it about halfway and then begin to go to the right, and you should find books like Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Those are all fairly long books. And then right after Ezekiel, you will find Daniel, a book of 12 chapters on page 1215. Which won't help any of you unless you happen to have the version that I have in front of you. But I want to think with you about Daniel, the man who lived 605 years before Christ. That's the date when we come to chapter 1. Man who lived in a very different world, a very different setting, a very different time, and yet he was enormously relevant to us. Daniel chapter 1. In the year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, this is the greatest military power of its day. Babylon is the world-conquering people at this stage in history. Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. Then he carried off to the temple of his God, and these he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylon and put in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring in some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well informed, quick to understand, qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned to them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among these were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names. Now each of their old names had a reference to the God of Israel. Either the El at the end, Daniel, El is the God, or Hananiah, the Yah is Yahweh, the name of God. The chief official gave new names: to Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. We, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, it was popular to talk about secular humanism. And all of a sudden, it seems, certain individuals discovered secular humanism. We were told secular humanism was the greatest danger of the time. And the Humanist Manifesto 1 and 2 were brought out, and we were told of the way in which the Humanist Manifesto had captured the attention of the educational world and all kinds of other areas, and what the humanists had plotted had taken over, and we had become a humanist society. Humanism is, by definition, rationalistic. It believes that human reason is the way in which we understand truth. It is, by definition, naturalistic. That is, it believes in what can be known from the senses is what can be known. And it does not believe in any higher source of information or revelation. It is anti-supernatural. And the Humanist Manifestos 1 and 2 were to usher into the world of secularism. And we were told how secularism and scientism and naturalism and anti-supernaturalism had taken over. The irony was, at the very time in which that was being trumpeted as the great danger in the United States, the culture was making a huge shift. And instead of being an anti-supernatural society, all of a sudden there was this huge openness to the supernatural. Not to the traditional understanding of Judeo-Christian supernatural, but Eastern mysticism and pantheism and polytheism, to New Age understandings in all different kinds. And all of a sudden we discovered to our chagrin that secularism as a philosophy was a factor in modern life, but it wasn't a very large factor. It, in fact, had been pushed into the corners. And all of a sudden there was this new openness to the spiritual. I watched a program on television I had not watched before last night, Touched by an Angel, and as I was watching it, I was struck by the fact of how many programs like that are now on television that 15 years ago, with the exception of the Michael Landon program, would not have even been thought of. And NBC has on every day a program is entitled something like The Other Side. which is how you get in touch with the paranormal and the spiritual, the supernatural, and you can phone the psychic hotlines. We live in a very supernatural-centered kind of society. Secularism is a philosophy of life that says we cannot know anything about the supernatural. Now, that remains an issue in parts of our society, but we live not so much in a secularist society as in a secularizing society. Let me make a distinction. Secularism is a philosophy that says this modern world is all there is, and it can only be known through the realm of reason and the natural. That's, as Carl Sagan said, the cosmos is all there is, and all there ever was, and all there ever will be. Secularization is a process. And what it does is not deny the existence of the supernatural. It doesn't deny the existence of that which is beyond the senses. What it does is push that to the weekends. It pushes it to the margins of society. It edges God out and says, you have a right to believe in whatever spiritual belief that works for you. Go for it. And it trivializes the supernatural by marginalizing it. It makes faith an issue on the edges of life rather than on the center of life. It reduces our understanding of God to the realm of the personal, to the realm of the private. And rather than allowing our understanding of who God is to come at the center of our life so that God, the living God, becomes the great center of focus in our life, he's reduced to an issue at the margins of life. Somebody's pointed out that if you travel through Europe, you can immediately see even a kind of shifting of the focus. If you go through some of the great old cities of Europe, you will notice that the center of the city is the cathedral, the great church. Buildings were not allowed to be higher or taller than those great historic churches. But now you go to any of those same cities and you'll find them dwarfed by businesses, and you'll find churches operating on the periphery. Now, there's nothing wrong with that geographical location. The point is, though, there's a kind of symbolism about the way in which faith and God have been reduced to the edges of life. Daniel didn't live in a secular society. It was a religion-soaked society. All around them were the gods as he came to Babylon. But what he was being called to do is the same thing we're being called to do. He wasn't asked to give up faith in Yahweh. He wasn't asked to give up faith in the Lord God of heaven. What he was asked to do was just to put him on his God shelf, along with a number of others, to serve him, but to serve him at the edges of his life rather than at the core of his being. And in that way, you and I can identify with Daniel, although his world is very different from ours. Now, I want to think with you through these first verses as Daniel is challenged with absorption, with assimilation. It strikes me that he's called to live by God in a very hard place. Enculturation. Nebuchadnezzar taking him, putting him in Babylon, 14, 15-year-old boy, facing all of this power of an alien culture. And I want you to notice three things that are going on. First of all, in verses 1 and 2, there was the sheer overwhelming power of this culture that he was facing. He came from a defeated nation. Verse 1 makes it clear that Judah had been invaded and overpowered. Nebuchadnezzar had swept in, the city had been besieged, and Jehoiakim the king had had to give up. It was the end of a process. Israel or Judah had been defeated spiritually. And you read the prophets, Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, as they call the people to an understanding that they'd given away their hearts. They'd been defeated militarily. They'd been defeated politically. And for a 14-year-old boy to be faced with the fact that the society in which he's grown up and which was he taught was the people of God on earth is this insignificant, defeated minority at the sheer power of the Hitler of the time, Nebuchadnezzar, because that was his moral character. It's an overwhelming experience. But he was not only part of a defeated people, he was brought to Babylon. You need to feel Daniel as he walks to Babylon in his procession of captives. And as he saw Babylon, he had never seen anything like it. The walls of the city were incredible. They were huge. They were thick. You could drive chariots two and three abreast around the walls of that city. He'd never seen anything like the sheer power. He was like a little kid from the sticks being brought into the big city. As he walked down the processional way, he couldn't help but be overwhelmed by the magnificence of the architecture and the luxuriousness of the temples, the sheer wealth that was on display. He's taken to the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, and then he was taken up and perhaps shown one of the wonders of the ancient world, the Hanging Gardens. And as he faced this, all he could feel would be a sense of intimidation and overpowering strength on the part of the Babylonians. The cultural might of these people oozed out of every pore. I was reminded recently about an event that occurred in Canadian history. There was a rebellion against the government back in 1984-85. It was led by a group of mixed race, mainly Indian and French people. They're called the Métis in Canada. And the West was still being settled, and Crowfoot was chief of the Blackfoot Indian who lived around the area of Calgary. And Crowfoot was being increasingly drawn into this Indian war and called to join Louis Riel, who was the leader of that movement. And the governor of that area, the Northwest Territory, was a wise man, at least for the sake of the crown. And he gave Crowfoot and his leading Indians a trip to the city of Winnipeg on the train. And we're told that up until now, he'd only seen small and scattered settlements of the white settlers as they came across the country. But when he was taken to Winnipeg, he saw a bustling city of 25,000 people. Now, that's not much to us. But when all you've seen is a cluster of 50 and 100 people, and you saw the railroad and he saw the cities, and we're told that immediately that Crowfoot saw the city of Winnipeg and the power of it, he said, I'm not going to fight these people. I can't do it. And the reason I mentioned that is you need to feel how Daniel felt, intimidated and overpowered. It's sometimes the way those who seek to follow Christ feel when they walk on a university campus and they find the whole bent of the culture is going on another direction. When you turn on your television set and you find that every value you've been taught to be true is challenged in one form or another, and you can keep turning channels and you find there's a consistent feeling about it. You walk into the bookstore and you discover the hosts of books on the shelves and you begin to think everybody's saying something different. And you feel the overwhelming power of a culture that's seeking to absorb you. Seems to me that's the first thing Daniel faced. And we can identify somewhat with that. The power of an alien culture that's overwhelming. Second thing that strikes me that he's facing is a very seductive appeal. Notice in verse 3, Nebuchadnezzar wants to involve a policy. Now, he's not doing what most kings of the time did, and that's ethnic cleansing. One of the policies that the Assyrians had followed is, if you conquer an enemy, wipe out the best and the brightest. Get rid of them, and then you'll have a subservient people. Nebuchadnezzar's procedure is exactly the opposite. He gathers the best and the brightest. You notice how they're described in verse 3. They are the royal family and the nobility, the aristocrats. They're the people who physically have no defect whatsoever. And these are the most gifted physical specimens. They are the brightest intellectual individuals. They are showing aptitude for every kind of learning. Well-informed, quick to understand, qualified to serve in the king's palace. I mean, talk about a group of young men who've got everything going for it. Think of any high school campus, take the cream. Physically, intellectually, socially, culturally, alert, adaptive, insightful, and almost always ambitious. I mean, because when you know you're good, you know you're good. And you begin to realize, I can lead. I've got a future in front of me. And Nebuchadnezzar says to these young men, in effect through Ashpenaz, listen, I want you to understand the possibilities are endless. You can have power, you can have prestige, you can have position. All you need to do is allow me to train you, and the sky's the limit in terms of where you can go in Babylon. Now think about these young men. 14 years of age, 15 years of age. Taken at the power of the sword away from their families. Some of you need to understand, because you've got 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds. What would happen if some people swept in and took away your children and put them over in another country? How well would they do? No family support system, no cultural support system, only a few others, in this case, three others. Not just three others in number, I think there was a good number from Judah, but we're named four. Striking thing is, of all of those who were taken, four made it, as far as God was concerned. Daniel is, I said, about 14 or 15 years of age. One of the ways and we know that is because that's the age that people were traditionally trained at this time. The second way we know it is that 70 years from this date, he's still functioning as a leader in the nation. So he obviously wasn't 30 years old, functioning at the age of 100. Most he can be is 14 or 15. And he represents the best and the brightest. And he's standing now before the chief figure under Nebuchadnezzar. And it's flattering. Incredibly flattering to be told, you can go as far in this country as you want to go. It responds to some values and natural abilities that they have. One of the things that culture does to us is not just intimidate us, it seduces us. It appeals to things that are in us. And these young men, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, felt the pull of saying, I can get an education, I can get a position, I can go places. All I need to do is sign in on the program. Third thing I want you to notice. The power of this alien culture was overwhelming. The power of this alien culture was seductive. The power of this alien culture is unrelenting. It isn't just going to be a moment decision. It's going to be a three-year program. You notice it says in verse 4, he was to teach them the literature, the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years. After that, they were to enter the king's service. It wasn't just they were brought in and said, become Babylonians. All they were told was, come on in and we'll begin to train you. And we'll begin to teach you. And they didn't have an option. It was a life or death option. I mean, to say no was death. And there's three parts of the program. I want you to notice, first of all, the decision was to change their worldview. Change the way they viewed reality. To teach them the language and literature of the Chaldeans, of the Babylonians. Here's what one commentator says about that. To begin to study Babylonian literature was to enter a completely alien thought world. The accumulated literature included omens, magic incantations, prayers and hymns, myths and legends, scientific formula for skills such as glassmaking, mathematics, and astrology. According to the Sumerians and Babylonians, two classes of people inhabited the universe, the human race and the gods. Preeminence belonged to the gods, although they were not all equal. At the lower end of the divine scale came a host of minor deities and demons, while a trinity of great gods, Anu, Elil, and Ea, stood at their head. A modern scholar will observe that many of these gods are personifications of parts or aspects of nature. The sun and the moon god are obvious examples. What am I trying to say? That as they studied, they were being introduced to a totally alien world. They've been taught that there is one god. Now they're going to be introduced to the occult, to all these various gods and goddesses and the understanding of these people. And over 3 years, they were going to learn that literature inside and out, so they knew it. And the idea was obviously so they would begin to think and understand and act and practice on the basis of Babylonian presuppositions. They were being challenged to change their worldview by education. Second, they were being challenged to change their lifestyle. It says in verse 5 that the king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. Now remember, this is a group of young men who've been under siege in Babylon. You can read other books and discover what that siege was like. Being under siege meant that the water was cut off. It meant the foods were cut off. They had not enjoyed a good meal for weeks and months. And now, all of a sudden, the king's table is in front of them. The finest of food, the finest of wines, the finest of living style, the most luxurious things you can imagine, to be brought in out of a place of being a prisoner, under prisoner of war camp conditions. And all of a sudden, the king's table, the king's wine, the king's palace And it's all there. Third thing they were being challenged was a change of loyalty. Change worldview, change lifestyle, change loyalty. That was very subtle. You know, if you're going to make it here, your name really sounds strange to us, and we're going to give you another name. Daniel? Daniel had learned from his parents that his name meant, God is my judge, or God will judge, to Belteshazzar. We're not sure precisely the meaning of it, but undoubtedly in it is Bel, may Nebo, may Bel, the god of the Babylonians, protect. And I won't go into all of those names, but every one of the names is changed from a name that brings reference to Israel's God to a name that brings reference to a god or a religious idea of the Babylonians. And subtly they were having their names changed. So their loyalties would be changed, because names weren't just labels. They were part of their identity. Sociologists tell us that in terms of acculturation, there's kind of four stages. There's the first stage of association, in which we're exposed to values. Then there's the second stage of accommodation, in which we become tolerant of values, which at first we may have rejected. Alexander Pope said a long time ago, vice is a creature of such frightful mien as to be hated needs but to be seen. But seen too oft, grown familiar with his face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. And they were being, first of all, introduced to values, then called to be tolerant of values. The third stage is assimilation, when they begin to cooperate with values, and finally amalgamation, when they adopt those values. And in a subtle way, that goes on in our lives. We're exposed to values. We are asked to be tolerant of values. We're asked then to begin to cooperate with those values. And finally, we begin to find we've adopted those as our own. And Daniel apparently had no visible means of support. But we wouldn't be telling the story if Daniel had just become a Babylonian. He didn't become a Babylonian. He became a man of God. Notice verse 8. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine. Strikes me that he had several options. One is he could collaborate. He could go along. I mean, forget Jerusalem. You're in Babylonia now. Forget your parents and what you've learned from your parents. You're never going to see them again. They're gone. Forget Judah. It's destroyed. You've got to make it in Babylon. That's where you are. That was a policy that many of his compatriots followed. He could have chosen another choice. He could have said, I'm going to fight this every step of the way. I'm going to confront it. I'm going to put my life on the line, and I am going to be a resistor. I will die rather than cooperate. I am going to attack. I'm going to oppose. When I get a chance to talk to Ashpenaz or Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to tell them exactly what I think of Babylon. And I'm going to spill it out. I would rather spill my blood here than stay another moment in Babylon. Intriguingly, Daniel does neither of the two. Daniel doesn't collaborate, and he doesn't confront. He chooses to make a principled contribution. And I want you to think with me about that phrase. He chooses to make a principled contribution in a culture, in a society, in which he was called by God to live, whose values were not his values, whose beliefs were not his beliefs, and for 70 years he serves in the midst of a society whose values were not his, and he contributes. But the reason he makes a contribution is because it was a principled contribution. At the entranceway to the situation, he says, no, there are things you cannot buy, there are things you cannot have, there are things you cannot own. I will live and serve in Babylon, but I will live and serve in the midst of this secularizing, powerful, alien culture as God's man, not your man, Nebuchadnezzar. You may seem to control my body, but you will never capture my heart. You will never capture my soul. And it says, he resolved not to defile himself. with the king's food and the king's wine. I've pondered that. I thought, why? I mean, maybe he didn't like the diet. I don't think that was the reason. Maybe it was because it wasn't kosher, that it hadn't been treated the way the Old Testament said it was to be treated. And that might apply, but wine wasn't part of kosher rules, so it's hard to relate it to that. Some think that he just was a vegetarian and didn't like meat. But later in the book, we find him eating meat. Some have thought, well, it was because the food was offered to idols, and he wouldn't do it because it involved meant involvement in idolatry. And I think that probably comes the closest to an understanding, and yet my question is, why wouldn't vegetables be offered to the idols? Everything was. I'm not precisely sure. But Daniel knew that there was a place at which he needed to draw the line, and if he bought into the lifestyle, he would defile himself. I find it striking, by the way. He was willing to accept the education. He became a leading expert. He knew more than any of the others, we're told before the chapter's over, in Babylonian culture. He chose to accept the education. He chose to accept the name. But he wouldn't adopt the lifestyle. I think the reason's simple. If he bought the lifestyle, he would soon begin to adopt the worldview. I don't know how many times I've had college students come to me after their first year away at school and begin to talk about some of the doubts they're having. And the doubts are significant and the doubts are genuine. Sometimes that's all it is, but others have come to me and we begin to talk about doubts and I discover these doubts are not being fed by intellectual questions. They're being fed by moral life choices. And they've begun to live a certain kind of lifestyle or being seduced by that, and now they're trying to find a way of justifying it. And Daniel was alert enough to know that a lifestyle choice would determine everything about the rest of his life. And he drew a line. And he said, there are parts of me you cannot own. There's a boundary I will not cross. I believe in what God has said, and I will choose to be submissive to God. Now, let me try and define something that's been useful for me to make a distinction on. There are issues in our life that are biblical absolutes. Biblical absolute is an issue of revelation. God has said it, it's clearly spoken in His Word, and to compromise that is clearly to go against everything God has said. Thou shalt not commit adultery. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. No kinds of rationalizations. Adultery is sin. It is contrary to the will and purpose of God. There are other issues in our life that are personal convictions. They're not issues so much of the Bible has clearly said it. It's a personal conviction. It's a question of wisdom. It's a question of an understanding that says, although God has not clearly spelled it out in His Word, knowing myself, knowing God's will, knowing God's purpose in my life, I believe that God wants me to follow this kind of thing in my life. Now, there's all kinds of issues we have in our life. Some things are prejudices. I feel something about this. Some of my prejudices are sinful. Some of my prejudices are irrelevant. I mean, I don't know why I cheer for some teams against another and why I don't like some teams. I got a kind of prejudice about it. It's a kind of unformed thing. Other things are preferences. I prefer. I like this. I dislike that. Other things are opinions. I think this. I think that. But a wise people spend a long time thinking about the difference between prejudices, preferences, opinions, and convictions. Convictions are issues that we've pre-decided. Convictions are issues of wisdom that come from spending time with God, spending time in God's Word, spending time with God's people, hammering out those issues in my life that say, I will not do this. I will become this kind of person. Convictions relate to character. Convictions are forged in the question of who do I want to become? And in a secularizing society, one of the central questions in our life is not simply what are our biblical absolutes, but what are our personal convictions. Then there's another level, and that's personal freedoms, personal choices. Where God has not spoken, where He's thrown it open and said, it's a choice. It's an issue of freedom. Guard yourself. Now, the tragedy in our society is we've collapsed everything into number three. We've collapsed biblical absolutes down into personal choices. We've collapsed personal convictions down into personal choices. And we'll be talking about that more next week. But Daniel had a conviction. He had pre-decided, I will not defile myself. And he knew that to eat that food would not simply be an issue of what went into his mouth, but what he became in his heart and in his character. So let me ask you, what have you pre-decided on as convictions? When you turn on your television set, what have you pre-decided? When you go into another city where nobody knows you, what have you pre-decided about what you'll do with your eyes and what you'll do in the places you go? When you make business decisions and certain gray issues are brought in front of you, what are your convictions? It's too late in the situation to form convictions. Daniel didn't wait till he got to Aspenaz to determine his conviction. Daniel resolved in his heart. And in a society that squeezes us, edges got out, it will be people who've made personal conviction choices in the presence of God who stand. And Daniel's choice was to cooperate without compromise, to be God's man in Babylon, not to opt out, not to take to the hills and live in a cave and try and preserve his life, to serve in the midst of the need of the time, to live right in the middle of that situation, but to be God's man there. And that's, I think, God's calling for us. We've got all kinds of people who want to opt out of the 1990s. But God's calling is for us not to turn back the clock to become the 1950s, but to be Babylon or Daniel's in Babylon. And make a contribution, a principled contribution to the glory of God, where they will have our service, but they will not have our hearts. Now notice what goes on. I want you to see with me the incredible wisdom of this 14-year-old boy. It says in verse 8, he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and sympathy to Daniel, but the official told Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who's assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other men your age? The king would then have my head because of you. Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, give us nothing but vegetables to eat or water to drink, then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food and treat your servants in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. Now let me suggest to you that if Daniel's choice was conviction without compromise, his strategy is cooperation without being co-opted. Without co-optation is the word that's there in the notes. But without being co-opted. Now, I'm struck by this. The first thing he did was he was respectful. He resolved not to defile himself. But rather than just blurting out his convictions with crankiness and with contentiousness, he's respectful to Ashpenaz. And he's compassionate toward Ashpenaz. My life's on the line here, Daniel, if I do this. And he'd earned his way into the heart of those whom he served. I'm struck by this. I'm very impressed by Daniel because I don't think I've worked this out in my own life. How do you carry convictions with compassion? How do you hate Babylon and still respect Ashpenaz and Nebuchadnezzar? We're not very good at that in our time. But Daniel showed respect for Ashpenaz, and if we had the time to go through the book of Daniel, incredible respect for Nebuchadnezzar, even though he hated all kinds of things that Nebuchadnezzar was opposed to. And he treats him with respect and kindness. He also showed a creativity. I mean, called to the pressure, he thought through the alternative. He thought through the options. His only choice wasn't to say, I'm not going to eat the food. He thought about how I can maintain my position here, how I can continue to make a contribution. So he comes up with a creative alternative. But bottom line, there's trust in God. Because I want to suggest to you, 10 days of vegetable diet wouldn't make enough difference. That apparently quickly. And he was in effect saying, Lord, you're going to have to intervene here. And underneath it all is a resolute, vibrant trust in God. Lord, I want to be respectful to them. Here's the option. Lord, if you don't step in, this isn't going to work. But notice, God did step in. Verse 15 brings us to the third point. Daniel's success is involvement with integrity. It says in verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the food. So the guards took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables and said, I bet Daniel and his friends were really popular at that stage with the rest of these guys. To these four young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them in, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them. He found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them. He found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. I love that statement. Here are young men committed to compete in the middle of an alien culture, and they compete with excellence. They are demonstrably superior on the Babylonians' own terms. They modeled a better way. They didn't just choose to be outside the system calling names at those who were in the system, but in the middle of the system, they demonstrated that people who live before God can be people of integrity and excellence and skill. Hey, they're 10 times better. And I say especially to some of you who are young men in college and in high school, God's hand be on you as young men and young women to say, I want to serve my generation by the will of God and God helping me. I want to be demonstrably different. Not because of my innate ability, but because God's hand is on me. I'm not going to defile myself, but I'm going to make a contribution, a principled contribution to my times. And I believe God can use me in the midst of this to bring witness to Nebuchadnezzar. In the midst of a secularizing society, I want to live as a person whose God is central in his life. And then notice verse 21. It simply says, Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. You need to put beside verse 1 of Daniel chapter 1, 605. That's the year, 605 BC. You need to put beside verse 21, 538 BC. 67 years, 4 pagan kings. And as we get to the end of the book, Daniel's maintained his integrity. Some of you need to understand, when Daniel was thrown into the lion's den, he was an 85-year-old man. I mean, he was always fighting those issues. He wasn't a 15-year-old boy. He's 15 in chapter 1, chapter 6. He's 85 years of age, still fighting for his God, still bearing witness, making a principled contribution. Everyone from Jerusalem didn't make it. Daniel and his 3 friends did. And they didn't make it by default. They made it because they always knew who was in charge. In a secularizing society that edged God out, they brought God in. Bob Buford, in his 40s, talks about as a very successful businessman going through success panic. I've mentioned it before, but at a crucial point in his life, wrestling with all kinds of choices, he met with an atheist as a strategic planning consultant, Mike Cammy, who is known as one of the top strategic consultants, and he began to talk about all the issues in his life and all the choices and all of the directions in which he could go. And Mike Cammy talked about the box. Talked about how in a strategic consulting, there's a box. You've got to determine what's in the box, the central question. Finally, he looked over at Bob Buford and he said, I've been listening to you for a couple of hours and I'm going to ask you, what's in the box? For you, it's either money or Jesus Christ. If you tell me what it is, I can tell you the strategic planning implications. But if you can't tell me, you're going to go back and forth. What's in the box? What's your life about? What does it consist of? And that's the question for all of us. What's in the box? Daniel purposed to live as God's man in Babylon under incredible pressure. God owned his heart. Father, may we, as we sing, about what a mighty God you are as we close. And as we put our gifts in the offering bag, be reflecting more deeply on who's in the box and what's in the box.